Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, November 28th, and Alex is here with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you for having me, Nima. All the best. Good to join you.
Yeah. Let's start with your latest piece on your Substack. You're talking about the possibility of having a false flag operation in the United Kingdom. What's your take in London? I don't know if... what's the main reason that you're thinking this way?
Okay, so today is Thanksgiving in the United States, 28th November. Yesterday, I was finalizing the follow-up report on the UK that I published an article about the UK at the end of the summer on I think 26 August. And I was working on a follow-up, because I think that Britain was on the verge of financial collapse. And the only way you can avoid financial collapse if you completely unleash money printing. And then, you know, the central bank provides all the liquidity needed by the government and by the banking system to carry on, to backstop the bad debts that cannot be repaid. And so that the system doesn't seize up, that it doesn't grind to a halt. And then you have like a depression, a collapse into an economic depression. But what you achieve by printing money without limits is that you start creating inflation that begins to accelerate. It takes time, but this way you give yourself maneuvering space rather than having all at once the system collapsing. So this is what happened, and I think this is an event that is going to be for history books. You know, possibly something on the order of the Weimar Republic or the collapse of the Soviet Union. And as I was working on this, you know, I looked at my phone, and on YouTube, I got a random suggestion by a guy in London, a short video saying, "Why are all the webcams in London dark?" or something like that, you know, that kind of a title. And I was absolutely astonished. I could not believe what I was reading. And I checked a little bit, and literally all the hundreds of webcams in London went dark. And one of them showing Westminster Bridge is showing the last image taken, which was on, I think, 3rd September around 4:50 in the afternoon. And so that at least gives us the clue when somebody made a decision to switch off all the webcams. And I thought, that is extremely strange. Why would all the webcams in London, you know, major European city, go dark? What is the reason? You know, that it can be random. It can be a fluke. Somebody had to have made the decision, but why? And to me, the only explanation that makes any sense at all is that they're planning a false flag attack. And then, you know, all of these other elements started to make sense. Like, why are they escalating the war against Russia, which they have already lost? You know, like, you've already lost the war. You cannot win it. You cannot reverse it. You're not achieving anything by authorizing long-range strikes at Russia, other than making yourself the belligerent. So no upside and a lot of downside. A rational player at this point would say, like, we lost. We have to sit down at a table and negotiate an end to this. But of course, you know, this is far, far too important. This is not Vietnam. This is not Afghanistan. They're not just going to pack up and leave Ukraine. This is all or nothing. We have numerous statements by you know, Western leaders and decision makers who are telling us if we lose Ukraine, it's over for the West. It's the end of the Western global order. We lose the world for generations. We lose the hegemony, as Boris Johnson put it, and so on and so forth. So it's not just we lose our foothold in Afghanistan, we lose Vietnam, you know, we get hamstrung in Syria or something. This is existential to the imperial cabal. And so, you know, if you decide, hey, let's do this, let's and keep antagonizing Russia, let's strike deeper into Russia proper, even though there's no way to win, there's nothing, you know, like we're going to cause them some scratches, but we're not going to win. But what we are going to do is we're going to provoke them. And I think that the sense of the provocation would be the hope that Russia would do something impulsive and then strike at a NATO member nation to give them the pretext to invoke Article 5 and then to start the, you know, the march to, you know, World War III, you know, like the irreversible NATO collective whole of society effort to confront Russia and to launch the next world war on the European continent. Of course, you know, they know that Vladimir Putin is very, very unlikely to take the bait. He just has to wait out the Joe Biden administration. The West cannot harm Russia, so there will be no reason to give them this gift, right? The gift of escalation. So they know that Vladimir Putin is not going to do it. He's not going to fall for the provocation. He's not going to take the bait. So it would be futile to keep launching these missiles into Russia to no effect. But this is where the false flag comes into the game, because you then make sure that an attack on London, for example, does happen. And then you say, like, aha, Vladimir Putin has been threatening a nuclear attack, and now he finally did it. Look, there's a nuke that went off in London. And I can't imagine how this could be done. You know, the nuclear devices must have very secure chains of custody. But this is why it also explains for what reason on earth the Biden administration suddenly started discussing giving Ukraine nuclear weapons, because then the chain of custody would end in Ukraine, right? And from Ukraine, then these nuclear devices would be free to roam and drift back to London. I don't know how, maybe on those CIA extradition flights or MI6 secret flights, or maybe they could be put on a truck or a shipping container, and then they could be detonated at some point in London and cause mass human casualties, mass casualty event. And so if, I don't know, if there was a webcam there, maybe it would leave evidence of where the device was detonated, where the explosion, you know, and then they could, you know, people could investigate and find out, no, this was not a missile, this was not a rocket, this was a planted device. This was a false flag attack. And after nearly 3 years of war in Ukraine, I'm sure that British intelligence has enough fragments of Russian missiles that they could pack it in there, and that you could find made in Russia all over London, and they could say, you see, there's evidence. We have evidence. It was the Russians. And so I think, you know, two scenarios, if you, you know, kind of think through the logic of the situation, two scenarios emerge to my mind. One of them is that if this story goes viral and people say like, oh my God, they might actually be planning something like this, because, you know, false flag attacks are through history not such an unusual thing, particularly at such an important moment, you know, when the cabal, the imperial cabal, lost in Ukraine. Trump administration is coming in less than 60 days, and there's risk that they're just going to close the chapter on Ukraine, and that's it. That's game over for them. And so it's for them, it's now or never. And they know that Vladimir Putin will probably almost certainly not respond to these pinprick provocations and gift them the pretext to invoke Article 5 of the NATO treaty. So the only card to play would be the false flag attack. And we've seen, you know, Gulf of Tonkin, the, you know, the Lusitania, the, whether it's versus against internal enemies, the,
we had in Syria.
Sorry?
We had false flag operation in Syria against Bashar.
Yeah, the exactly. And then we had the Ghouta attack. We have, you know, like this happens all the time. And this is what agencies like MI6 and CIA and the Mossad, this is what they specialize in. This is what they do. This is what they sit around and discuss and war game and think about from 9 to 5 when they go to work. And that's what they do. You know, this is not unusual. So it shouldn't be too far of a stretch to think that they must be planning this now. And so, you know, if the story goes out and people take the awareness, then you preempt the, how do you call it, the mass formation psychosis element. Because if they, for the false flag attack to work, it has to take people by surprise. There has to be that really powerful emotional impact. And then, you know, the media already has their script. You know, they're already prepared with their script. Remember on September 11, when the BBC ran the story about the World Trade Center 7 collapsing more than 20 minutes before it actually collapsed? Well, this is the, you know, this is the evidence of this. Like, they have their script prepared, because they have to run with the narrative during that emotional moment for the public, and then you start to create the how do you call it, the mass formation psychosis, right? That Professor Matthias Desmet explained so well for us, and this is where you turn the population from being very, very unwilling to engage in a war against Russia to saying, all right, they struck us. Now we go and fight them and kill them. And so this would be the only way for the imperial cabal to sweep the problems at home under the carpet and to send people off to war and to try to save their silverware in Ukraine, to recuperate Ukraine for them. So I would say that it's probably a certainty that they're planning this. Whether they will succeed or not, who knows? Whether they are even going to be able to pull it off or not, who knows? But I think it's absolutely a certainty that they are planning it. And I think that the evidence for this is the fact that all the webcams are off in London. Actually, one of my readers found that the webcam on Abbey Road is still active. But, you know, it doesn't show much of anything. It just shows the street. So that's the one scenario, you know, like where we front run them and the public awareness goes a step ahead of the false flag planners. The second, more ominous scenario is if the Russians are aware of it, and I can't imagine that they're not. That, you know, if I were sitting in the Kremlin, I would think, okay, so we need to front run this, meaning that instead of them waiting to pull off a false flag attack, you actually attack them first. Why? Because they plan an event, they're going to execute, and then they're going to fill the public emotional and information space with the needed narrative. So they are in control of the narrative. If you hit them first, and I'm not talking about a nuke, I'm talking about a different kind of attack, but maybe on Britain proper, maybe, you know, dropping something like Oreshnik on the MI6 headquarters or on the Downing Street or some military installation, then they can't run with that same narrative, and then now they're scrambling. Now they have to kind of report randomly, you know, like the whole plan of controlling the media space immediately collapses. Now you're not controlling it, and now the narrative kind of makes itself. It goes spontaneously, so it's a very different situation. And maybe if you struck the right targets, and I'm sure that the Russians will know how to do that, then you also very powerfully weaken the adversary's ability to mobilize against you. So it would probably be weapons depot, military centers, logistical hubs, and things like this. And so I think it would be much, much better if the story went around the world and everybody knew it and expected it, and that kind of had the same effect as, you know, disabling Israeli attacks on Iran when their plans were outed. So if this plan is outed, and I'm really thankful that we're talking about this, then maybe we can preempt it. Otherwise, you know, if the Russians take matters into their own hand, it might be World War III, you know, and nobody should think that the Russians are afraid of that. Let's remember, you know, when Napoleon came to Moscow, rather than letting him take Moscow, the Russians burned the whole city down. They're not joking around. So we shouldn't think that they're going to allow themselves to be defeated by hesitating or being fearful. They will act when they make the decision. And now we're at such a critical time that, you know, at the same time when the you know, this cabal in the West is planning false flags, the Russians are planning their contingencies. And, you know, these contingencies could be very, very powerful strikes against Western interests.
Yeah. You mentioned, because I think one of the main reasons that you're mentioning the strike on London and this false flag operation or attack is the situation that you're witnessing between Russia and the United Kingdom, which is so critical right now. It's so fragile, the situation, I think, because basically in Europe, considering all European countries, is the United Kingdom who's running the show in Europe. And recently they were talking that they're going to send troops together with France to Ukraine to fight Russians. As we know that Financial Times reported that they're asking, the Biden administration is asking Ukrainians to reduce the age of those people who are going to be part of the conflict on the battlefield, because they want to reduce it from 25, if I'm not mistaken, to 18 years old. This is huge. You just go literally devastating, destroying a nation if you go in that direction. And do you find it, Alex, we've been talking about Donald Trump and his mindset about the conflict in Ukraine. Do you think, with all that said, and with what we've seen so far from those people who are going to be part of his administration, is he really serious in what he's talking about? Because these people are totally unbelievable. The way that they're talking about Russia, it's not just about the policy. We had the Biden administration who were so, as Colonel Wilkerson called it, smarmy people, those who are trying to show that they're polite. But these people who are just showing everything that let's go crush Russia. Russia should accept whatever is on the table on the part of the United States. How do you see? Because all these people coming to the administration putting some sort of pressure on Donald Trump. And he has this experience from his first term.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm taken aback. I find it extremely strange. You know, with regards to the internal policies of the United States, I find most of the appointments and their programs, as well as Donald Trump's own statements, to be extremely encouraging. You know, they're striking all the right notes, and they're really formulating the framework of thinking and solutions that are very, very badly needed and clearly very well thought out. When it comes to the foreign policy, it's surreal. It's almost like a grand betrayal of the electorate, because you ran on something and now all of your appointments are voicing something almost completely opposite. And I wasn't sure what to think about this. And I have to say that the appointment of Sebastian Gorka was particularly disappointed. I can't call him stupid, but I have a difficult time finding something smart that he says. You know, things he says don't really make sense, but he's saying them in this vulgar, thuggish way that almost makes John Bolton sound like Sergei Lavrov, you know, like a good diplomat. And so that's very perplexing to me. But on the other hand, you know, if we take the possibility of false flag into account, then suddenly it starts to make sense, because there clearly is this globalist imperial cabal that is desperate to trigger World War III. And they are deathly afraid of Donald Trump ruining it for them. And as a result, they might, trigger a false flag event. In which case, they might even be able to create the circumstances to simply not allow him to be inaugurated and to become a president at all. So he never even becomes president. And they might try to still assassinate him before he's ever inaugurated. So he is the target as well, not only Russia, right? And so the letting the dogs like Sebastian Gorka bark loudly in public could be a signaling strategy to say, don't worry, we're not going to ruin this for you. We're going to be mean to Russia like you want us to be. We're going to continue the same policy. You know, January 20th is not the end of the road for you. You still have maneuvering space. You will still have influence, and we'll still get, Ukraine back for you. We're going to rescue that situation for you. So if that is the case, then that would make sense. That would explain why you'd have Sebastian Gorka out there being this vulgar, you know, thug. Yeah, I mean, he'd get punched in the face in the pub and for the way he's speaking. And you know, because otherwise it doesn't make sense that on the one set of policy you have these well thought out constructive measures and appointments, but on the foreign policy, it's a complete crazy house. Anyway, so that's my thinking, and I think that that Donald Trump's first term maybe gives a little bit of credibility to this idea, because many things he has done in this way. As an example, you know, he wanted to withdraw American troops from Syria, and he was sabotaged by the deep state. He wasn't able to do that. And so what he did then is he turned around and he said, like, oh, I decided to keep the troops in Syria for the oil. We're doing it for the oil. He said it explicitly. Now, this seemed thuggish on his part, and it seemed very undiplomatic and unseemly for a statesman to be saying things like this. But what that actually did is that it blew out the public support in Europe completely from supporting the American policy in Syria. And then I think that the Dutch troops in Syria had to withdraw immediately. And the United States really did lose the support of its European allies for its policy in Syria over that. So, you know, Trump has, and then, you know, there was also the missile attack on Syria that he launched, which was another big disappointment. But then it turned out that he gave the Russians pre-advice that most of the missiles were shot down or they landed on an empty parking lot. And it was a completely ineffectual attack, but it did win him many points at home because, you know, the American journalists got to boast about the beauty of American weapons and all that. And then they said he was acting presidential for the first time, and everybody was happy. And the attack achieved absolutely nothing. So Trump does have this tendency of acting through, you know, like almost like a three-card Monty, where he wants to do something, but instead of doing it, he pretends he's doing something else. You know, he does things in a kind of deceptive way that gets the deep state a little bit misdirected. So we'll see. I think for the time being, I really reserve my judgment, even though, you know, Marco Rubio, Sebastian Gorka, and all these people like this are not encouraging. But, you know, at the same time, we know that they will not be making policy. They will be executing in an administration where we know that Donald Trump is not exactly a pushover. People have to do things his way, or they're not going to be doing things at all.
Donald Trump appointed Keith Kellogg to be his envoy in the conflict in Ukraine. And he was part of his administration in his first term. And right now he's gonna send him to find some sort of solution between Ukrainians and Russians. Here is what he said on Fox News.
I'm hoping that Jake Sullivan talked to Michael Waltz, who's going to be the incoming National Security Advisor, or President Biden has talked to President Trump and said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm really hoping that happened, because what he has done, Biden, through his action, he's actually given President Trump more leverage.
Really?
Because now he can pull back, he can go left, he can go right, he can do something. And I think what he did is he basically said, well, this is what I want to do, and I'm hoping there's something to this. I don't know, but it does give the President Trump more ability to pivot from that.
Oh, that's interesting. All right.
Just one quick question before we let you go. We have like 5 seconds, General. But so you're not buying the White House's, the Biden administration's justification that they approved these new long-range weapons because of the North Koreans on the ground inside Ukraine?
It sounds good, but what I'm really hoping is there was another reason to it, which gives leverage to President Trump. Maybe that may be a good reason to do it. Look, they should have been doing this a year ago. But they've basically pulled back. You don't fight a war allowing other countries to have sanctuaries. If you're going to fight a war, you fight a war. And we've we've basically pulled back on letting Zelensky fight a war that he should have been fighting a long time ago. Mm. I know the casualties were horrific.
Yeah, of course.
But the advantages that he had this last summer are not there anymore, he meeting Zelensky.
Well, to the best of my knowledge.
I cannot draw a line between these people and the establishment. They are part of the same mindset. And he's just arguing, as you saw, he's arguing that any sort of escalation right now with the Biden administration in Ukraine would favor Donald Trump's position in any sort of talk and negotiations with Russians. This is unbelievable. And these people are in charge of solving the situation.
Yeah, this is exactly what I'm talking about, because, you know, I struggle to understand what this man is talking about, because it sounds so stupid. It is truly staggering. And, you know, you have to think either these people are insane or they have 20 IQ or I don't know what, or they're doing something else. And I can't believe that they're so stupid. You know, like it's very hard to, you know, this is not high school. These people have a certain knowledge. They have a certain experience. Donald Trump has choices of, you know, getting General Mike Flynn there, getting Douglas MacGregor there. There are many generals in the American military establishment who are smart professionals who know. There's Scott Ritter who could be speaking there instead. But, you know, imagine putting Scott Ritter on Fox News to speak on behalf of Donald Trump. Well, you know, it would only get both Donald Trump and Scott Ritter killed. I think that the stakes are so high that they couldn't be any higher for the imperial establishment. And when I say imperial establishment, you know, I'm not just talking about some people high in the governments of United States and Europe and you know, the banks and the think tanks and large corporations. You know, I'm talking about the whole system, system of governance that has existed in the Western world for several centuries now, that has become entrenched, that draws its power from certain levers of society that it controls. And, you know, if you take away their hold on of those levers of power, then everything they have been building for the past few centuries collapses like a house of cards, and they will not allow this. They assassinated John F. Kennedy, the president of the United States. They assassinated a number of other presidents, including Abraham Lincoln. You know, there's a continuity to this clash between the occult oligarchy that rules the Western powers and their foreign rivals.
I even go to Watergate.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. So this is a constant theme, and today we are at a particularly acute moment of this conflict, because not only has this system of governance met determined enemies in Russia and in China and in Iran, but it is also meeting determined opposition at home, like Donald Trump and people who support him, like Viktor Orban, like the new president of Romania. I apologize that I still haven't absorbed his name correctly. Robert Fico in Slovakia. Oh, we remember they tried to assassinate him too, it's the game is hotting up very, very powerfully, and they do not hesitate to assassinate people, to destroy things, to orchestrate false flag attacks. They have absolutely no such scruples. And I think that this is crystal clear to Donald Trump and to people around him. And they have to reckon with that. You know, they can't just come out like lambs for slaughter there and say like, oh, this, here's what I will do. I commit to doing that. You know, it'll have to be played in a very different way. And I really do expect that there's extensive coordination between Donald Trump's team and the counterparts on the Russian side, and possibly similar counterparts on the Chinese side, and maybe some other players. I don't know, but I would be surprised if this wasn't the case. At the very least, they have to be exchanging information and telling one another what their intentions are and what they're going to do. And you know, maybe, you know, there's an understanding that we can't go out talking like, oh, we're going to be best friends with Vladimir Putin, so we're going to send out Sebastian Gorka, but when he starts to bark, just ignore him.
You know what's so amazing, Alex, when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine? It doesn't matter how much Russia shows that it's powerful and it's capable of doing and dealing with the conflict in Ukraine. And in terms of their economy, in terms of their military, it's just transforming hugely. If you look at the Russian military before the conflict in Ukraine started, and right now they're talking about washing machines, all of those rhetorics, if you remember. And right now with this new hypersonic missile, Oreshnik, and everybody's talking about what's this? Nobody knows how to evaluate, to assess the how powerful this missile is. And on one hand, as Russia shows how powerful it is in their economy, in their military, and how capable it is to deal with the conflict in Ukraine, on the other hand, you see the West is getting more delusional, and is getting deeper in those kind of propaganda that they have preaching for such a long time, that Russia is nothing, is gas station, is, you don't see any sort of reaction, a logic reaction from the West. Because when your enemy is powerful, at least you have to accept that it's powerful. Because if you're not accepting that, they can crush you, they can hurt you the way that you haven't expected before. But do you think that what's going on right now with the case of Ukraine and in the United States, are these people just playing to be stupid, or they know what's going on and they're planning for something bigger?
No, Nima, what they have to do is they have to keep up the pretense that we can defeat Russia. Because if it becomes obvious that we cannot, then any public support for war is going to collapse to zero, right? So they, you know, in order to engineer consent from the public, and you know, their whole game is to get all of us to volunteer as cannon fodder to go and fight Russians for them. So they have to persuade us that victory is possible, that Russia is weak, that Russia is about to collapse, that, oh, you know, they have these weapons, but they're experimental. They don't have very many of them, and they don't work so well after all. And, you know, they have to dispute this in every way that they can, or pretend that it's not happening and keep it out of the, you know, public discussions. But at the same time, you know, their logic of rule is not that they need to defeat Russia as a power militarily, the way they tried to do through Napoleon's invasion and the way they tried to do with Hitler's Operation Barbarossa. You know, it is enough for them to regime change Russia. So what they will continue to hope is that somehow they can destabilize the regime, and that they can then somehow put another Boris Yeltsin back into Kremlin, you know, some candidate of their own choosing, and that way that they could then muzzle up Russia and control it, and then all of that military power, all of that technology, they will co-opt it. They will try to use it themselves. And the first thing that they'll try to do is they're going to turn it against China. So, you know, it's the same playbook. You go in, you take control of the banks, then you can take control of the media. Then you start pumping in the Sinophobic hysteria into the Russian people. Then you orchestrate some false flag attack of the Chinese against the Russian in the East. And then you start the next war between Russia and China, and you have Russia kill China for you. So, you know, they rather than defeating Russia militarily, they would prefer to weaken it, you know, especially economically and politically, in order to maybe destabilize the regime, in order to get Vladimir Putin out of power, and then install some Juan Guaido or, you know, somebody like that into the Kremlin that they control. And then, you know, they get another lease of life on their system of governance, which, you know, in terms of foreign policy has always been divide and rule.
Yeah. Alex, as you mentioned, I think a very important example for the things that you've said is what's going on in Ukraine. Just imagine Ukraine before the conflict has started and Russia was willing to negotiate with Ukraine. You don't need to go there and fight it like Iraq and Afghanistan and destroy the country. You can put someone in power in Ukraine that guy would destroy the country for you. And you can capture whatever you want from that country.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And then even the way the public is inclined doesn't matter much because, you know, if we look at the way Ukrainian public was inclined towards Russia, it wasn't hostile at all. It took a lot for them to, you know, from 2014 onwards to create Russophobic hysteria. You know, they brought out these neo-Nazis to control the public sphere. The 12 days after Joe Biden came into power in Washington, Volodymyr Zelensky turned off three main opposition television stations, and they started making Russian language illegal, and they made the largest opposition party illegal, and they started calling Russian people very ugly derogatory names in the public in order to dehumanize them, in order to create conditions for war in the public. And even that didn't have to take all of Ukrainian society, but only a segment. And I listened to your interview with Colonel Jacques Beau, and he says how even just before the Russian invasions, when they asked Ukrainian people in the national polls, would you be willing to take up arms to defend Ukraine by force in case of Russian invasion? It was what, something like 16% of all Ukrainians said yes, and most of those are far in the west of the country. So even at that point, majority of Ukrainians had no anti-Russian feelings. They had no inclination to go to war, but you know this Western social engineering technology that is being applied to a whole society. It runs roughshod over this, and it forces people into the trenches to fight a war, even when they don't want to. And as we've seen, they've done a tremendously effective job of that in Ukraine. And I think that we have to take that into account and make sure that it doesn't happen to our societies, because I think that the next target for Nazification and militarization is Europe itself.
Does Europe feel the threat coming from this type of mindset, and do they really consider it?
Some people do, but I'm not sure that many people quite understand the extent of this threat. You know, they see that, you know, the European politicians are talking about war. They see that the will for war is being built up, that capital is flowing towards military and defense industries, that politicians are talking about conscription and so on and so forth. But they don't realize that at a certain point this becomes coercive, this becomes forceful. You know, you create these brown shirt movements, and we see them everywhere in Europe now. You know, we see them in Finland, in Germany, in France, in Croatia, in Hungary, in Sweden. You know, these are the embryos of Azov battalions and Aidar battalions and C-14 gang in Ukraine, which, you know, they serve the purpose of radicalizing Ukraine. You know, in 2015, 2014 maybe.
14, yeah.
When the Ukrainians launched the anti-terror operation, they found very quickly that the regular troops were not very interested in firing on their own citizens. So what they did is they seeded a small number of these members of Pravi sector of Azov battalion into the regular units to make sure that they don't decline orders when they're told to shoot at people, that they shoot at people. And they even go as far as placing them in the back of the formations to shoot at their own soldiers who don't want to fight against whoever they're ordered to fight against. So, you know, the emergence of these similar kinds of organizations and units throughout Europe is much, much more dangerous than people realize. You know, but people now look at these tiki torch parades in Europe, these Nazis with placards saying this and that. Usually it's something patriotic and, you know, kind of tolerable and digestible that even almost makes sense. That these are the people that a few years down the road could be throwing your sons into the vans and you know, shipping them to the Eastern Front, into the trenches. So, you know, right now people look at them as some kind of a curiosity that doesn't really matter very much because it's very marginal and nobody cares. The brown shirt movement in Germany, I think it started in 1930 with 200 guys. Nobody took them seriously. But by 1933, when Hitler came to power, they were close to 3 million. And they had tremendous political influence. So we need to take these people seriously, and we need to push back, because they really do have the plans to continue waging war against Russia. And when they finish with the last Ukrainian, they're going to turn to the Poles, Romanians, Bulgarians, Czechs, Slovaks, Croats, Spaniards, French, whoever.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today.
Great pleasure to join you again. Thank you. Take care, Nima. Bye.
Have a great time there. Bye-bye.